So tonight I want to speak about metta, sometimes translated as loving kindness. And metta is one of the four Brahma Viharas, the noble abodes that the Buddha continually encouraged people to practice and cultivate. And it's over the next 4 weeks, I'm counting this week, I'll be speaking about each of these four. So I'm just quickly reviewing. The four are metta, loving kindness, karuna, which is compassion, mudita, which is sympathetic joy, and upekkha, which is equanimity. And these four are so, they're interrelated, they play off each other, they encourage each other, they blend into each other in many places. But I'm going to try and sort of separate them out a little bit into these four things. So it's also interesting to think that we call this a noble abode. You see this word abode or abiding a lot in translations of the Buddhist teachings. This is where the Buddha is encouraging us to live at the level of our hearts. This is where he is encouraging us to live at the level of our hearts. And so basically the idea is simply that we, in the sutta it says that we have thoughts of loving kindness for all beings without exception. I'm not going to spend a lot of time with the sutta itself tonight. I'm going to approach this from a somewhat different angle. But it's like on the face of it, this seems like pretty simple. Like, well, I'm just gonna have nice thoughts about everybody. This was back when I was a hippie. That's what we all were trying to do, right? It was love and peace to everybody. We all think we're good people. And I'm not saying you're not. And that we don't have any problems in this area, that we're always full of goodwill. But the truth is, we all have problems in this area. Because it's that we're human. We all have reactive mental patterns that cause us to respond to certain people in certain situations with thoughts and even words and actions of ill will. Ill will being the opposite of goodwill or loving kindness. And these words and thoughts and words and actions cause suffering for ourselves and cause suffering for others. So what do we have, how do we, what do we do now? Now that we sort of, that's a statement of right understanding in a sense. So what can we do? And it would be nice if we could say, well, I'm going to resolve, right, starting right now, that absolutely I'm going to have no more thoughts of ill will ever again. It would be nice if we could just make a resolution like that and it would all be solved. But that's not going to happen because we're going to, just because of human nature, we're going to slip back into those reactive patterns over and over and over again. So, loving kindness is something we have to cultivate. And actually, being a gardener, I like that word. And I'm actually going to use I actually looked up the word cultivate in the dictionary. And it has actually three related definitions to the word. To encourage, to foster the growth of, and to prepare or prepare and use for the raising of crops. We're raising crops of wholesome thoughts, right? So, but this, all of these things, these all require effort. Well, we have to do something, and that's how the sutta begins. It says, the very first line of the Metta Sutta says, this is what should be done. It isn't, this is what we should think about. This is what should be done. It implies we must act as opposed to just think about it. And so let's take this analogy of raising crops in the context of wholesome effort. The sixth step in the Eightfold Path, because I think it's a very interesting way to look at Metta and the practice of metta. So if you want to prepare a field or even a small area in your yard to grow stuff in, you know, first you have to pick out all the big stones and all the weeds. You know, it takes effort to do that. I mean, if you've ever started picking stones and weeds out of a garden, you'll know it's a lot of work. And this is like the first part of right effort. First of the four pieces of right effort, which is to prevent unwholesome states of mind from arising and to get rid of unwholesome states that have arisen. You know, we'd like to think somehow that we're all naturally kind towards others, but we're not. And part of this is purely biological, you know, way deep in the back of our brainstem someplace, our subbrain or whatever you want to call it, there's this very deeply held instinctual energy that we're always there underneath other things that are going on that says, oh, you'd better watch out. You know, someone's going to come and attack us, or someone's going to come and steal our food, or it's going to steal my wife and my children and kill us. And, you know, all those things that happened 10,000 years ago when we were running around in animal skins on the plains out there. That was just how people lived their lives. They were also worried about being attacked by predators, and it was a very fragile existence. And that's deeply instinctually embedded in us, the sort of be on the lookout to, better not trust that person, because you never know what they might do, you know, that sort of vibe. This all tends towards fear and aversion, towards ill will for others. Because it's on, and we were reactive on this purely instinctual level. And then our current culture reinforces this idea over and over and over again. I mean, just anytime you go to the media, I mean, you know, just today there was the big headline, some guy in Maine randomly shot 17 people. And whether we think, well, that's in Maine, it's not my problem, right? But it is, because it can happen right here. It happened right here in Boulder a couple of years ago. This is, and this makes us, because this is what's reported all the time. You know, if you look at something I read, like, most of the news is bad news. You know, there's not a lot of good news in the news. It's mostly stuff like that, you know, this, because it's more sensational. And so we take that in, and that makes us feel more defensive, has ill will towards people, like, oh, this guy's an army reservist, right? All those army people, you know, they're all being trained to be killers, you know, that's where our mind goes. At least that's where my mind goes. I don't know where your mind goes, and that's where my mind went with this one. And then on top of that, we get all this stuff through advertising. That basically an ad says, if you don't have this, there's something wrong with you. So we start believing that we're not good enough. We don't deserve happiness. Yeah. These are all unwholesome mind states. These are all mind states that paint this grim picture of an undependable, unsatisfactory, from our point of view, of making us happy world. So to cultivate a wholesome mind state, we first have to see that this is the case, that this is to understand that we're going against the current, you know, the current of our culture and of our innate hardwired self energy is to be on the defensive and to judge others and to be averse to a lot of what's we're seeing. And so this is right understanding at the simplest level, right understanding. We have to see that this is true. Yes, this is where my mind goes. That this is what I keep being confronted with over and over and over again. But then, so that's one form, part of right effort. But the second part of right effort is to create conditions where wholesome mind states can arise and to preserve those mind states when they've arisen. Ah, something we can actually do. Other than just be aware and be constantly vigilant that we're not just caught in this unwholesome pattern I just described again. Can we do something about actually cultivating these wholesome mind states? Can we water them? Can we fertilize them, using my analogy again? Can we do stuff that it encourages them to actually grow in our hearts and minds? And this is the practice of metta. This is the intent of the practice of metta, is to literally cultivate wholesome mind states. I mean, the idea of the whole metta practice can be summed up as, let's just fill our minds with wholesome thoughts all the time, because we know, based on the Buddhist teaching, that if we're having a wholesome mind state, we're not having an unwholesome one. There's only room for one mind state at a time. So if more and more often we're having wholesome mind states, because we're encouraging them, we're cultivating them, that means we're going to have less and less of the other ones. This is the way the mind works. And so what you do when you practice is, when you think about it, it's just a very deep concentration practice, metta. It requires that you stay. You have these four phrases, and this, I'll just give you the most common ones. People have all kinds of different versions of this, so don't worry if this isn't exactly match what you're used to. But you have these four phrases that you just repeat over and over. May you be safe. May you be happy. May you be healthy. May you live with ease. And you repeat these both for yourself, so that the may you becomes I, because you have to feel good in yourself, but also for all other beings. And in the traditional form of this practice, you take different people in different categories that represent the broad group of everyone. But basically, think about what we're saying here. We're saying that someone, we're wishing them or ourselves that we always feel safe, happy, healthy, and at ease. And ease mean at ease meaning, not having to struggle in the world. This describes optimal conditions for practice. How could, there's nothing, we're not, there's going to be nothing much disturbing us if we always feel safe, happy, healthy, and at ease. There's nothing going to be going on, and the likelihood that unwholesome mind states arise in the first place is going to go way down, just simply because there's nothing to worry about. We have, I mean, on a simple level, not like I'm talking about stuff. I'm talking at an emotional, mental level. We have everything we need. If these conditions actually existed. And we just repeat the phrases, and your mind wanders, just like in my other forms of meditation practice. These phrases are just, what's are called the meditation object. We've chosen this particular object to be what we're going to focus the mind on. This is what we're going to concentrate on. These four phrases and the meaning of these phrases for a variety of people. And here's the tricky part. One of the tricky parts. There's a lot, actually, but it seems really simple until you get into the details. Traditionally, it's always said that you start, when you start this practice, the first most important person you can have thoughts of love and kindness towards is yourself. That's where you always start. And in every formal session of metta practice, you always do metta for self first. And sometimes, for some people, like when I was on this retreat, some people said, just stay with self for a whole week, do nothing but that. It might really change, because it breaks down that sense of we're not good enough. I deserve this. This is what every human being deserves, to have this as their baseline of their life. That's what they all deserve. So we have to take into our heart minds that this is important, that we can actually do this. I want to read a little something from the sutta here. And we're basically all, I just want to repeat this. All we're trying to do with this practice is replace the habitual reactive patterns we have to things with other patterns that are wholesome or more wholesome. Just all we're trying to do is like rewire our brain somehow, or our hearts, probably our heart mind, so that this, it's more commonly, this is what we do. It's what the Buddha has to say about this. This is a very famous quote from the Buddha from one of the suttas. Bhikkhus, whatever a bhikkhu frequently thinks and ponders upon, that will become the inclination of his mind. If he frequently thinks and ponders upon thoughts of sensual desire, he has abandoned the thought of renunciation to cultivate the thought of sensual desire. And then his mind inclines towards thoughts of sensual desire. And he goes on, the next one is, if he frequently thinks and ponders upon thoughts of ill will. It's like, oh, this is the classic Buddhist thing. You see this in memes on Facebook and places like that all the time. The Buddha said basically, whatever a bhikkhu frequently thinks and ponders upon, that will become the inclination of his mind. So if what we're thinking and pondering on is thoughts of goodwill, because we're repeating these phrases, that becomes the inclination of our heart mind. We're changing how we react to the world in the broadest sense by simply shifting the pattern of the mind by doing this practice. It's mind-boggling. The Buddha figured this out, 2,500 years ago, and he figured it out not through psychological testing or anything like that. This is just like he observed his own mind and said, "Oh, yeah, this is what he saw in his own mind." And here's another layer of this, however. We think, "Oh, yeah, I can see that. I can have thoughts of loving kindness towards people." But often when we think that, well, we're thinking about all the people like our friends, our family, our co-workers, maybe our favorite sports team, whatever, it's that limited world that we live in. But what the Buddha says over and over again in the Metta Sutta is he says this has to be for everyone, for all beings, without exception. So that means not only our close little collection of, well, a couple hundred people, maybe if we're really social, friends and family and things. But it means that person who's checking you out at the grocery store, who most of the time, and people like that, I'm just picking that as a common one. We all have that experience. We pretty much just ignore them. They're what in the Metta tradition and of teaching is called a neutral person. It's like, I don't, they're just like there. Well, that's like 7.5 billion beings, just the people part. Then we're talking about all beings. Well, then all the dogs and cats and all those other things as well. And we don't think of extending our thoughts of loving kindness to them at all. It doesn't even occur to us. But, can I be full of loving kindness and have thoughts of loving kindness towards the person who's checking out my groceries? Or handing me my dry cleaning at the dry cleaners like I did a couple of days ago? Can we do that? That's when things start to really change, when we expand our scope beyond those people that we naturally want to have thoughts of loving kindness towards anyway. And naturally, through whatever connections we have with those people, this seems normal almost. And then there's another layer. What about all those people we don't get along with at all? What in traditional metta teaching is called, the difficult person or the difficult people, because there's usually more than one in our lives. And certainly, as I keep discovering over and over again, the patterns of my mind are not full of ill will towards those people, though of goodwill. They're full of ill will. It's like, I want to get them. I want revenge. I want to sort of show them I'm right and they're wrong. All those sort of energies that come up. Can we have thoughts of goodwill towards them? Can we offer them loving kindness? I mean, truly, sincerely offer them thoughts of loving kindness? It's not easy at all to do that. It's like, oh yeah, well, but we get caught in those places of they don't deserve it. They are bad people. They're wrong. They don't, they've wronged me. All those patterns of thought we come up with all the time. But can we have thoughts of loving kindness towards them? Because that's what the Buddha demands. In the sutta, he doesn't pull any punches. He says over and over again, four or five places in the sutta, this must be for all beings without exception. And it's like, oh, that's an awful tall order all of a sudden when I have to take in those people. And it doesn't mean, and this is really important, for those people who are really difficult in your life, and some of them, have probably done great harm, perhaps even great harm to you in a variety of ways. Having thoughts of loving kindness towards them, wishing them those four phrases, that they're safe, happy, healthy, and at ease, doesn't mean in any way that you condone how they've acted in the past or that you love them or that you even like them. It just means you wish them well. Because they're just another, at one level, they're just another being just like you. We all want to be happy without, there's no one I've ever met who hasn't said at some point or other, yeah, I just want to be happy. When it comes down to the right at the base level of everything, that's what we all want. And they may act and speak in ways that for us like are the opposite of anything that could ever bring us happiness. And maybe it doesn't bring them happiness either. But we can't reject them. Say, oh, sorry, I have to leave those ones out. We have to bring this to everyone without exception. I want to read some things from here. This is from Sharon Salzberg's book, Loving Kindness. And I want to come back now to now that I've talked in these broad terms, that this whole practice begins, has to begin with thoughts of loving kindness towards yourself. You have to love yourself. And that's like, for some people, like a huge problem. I understand that. And we all have times when we don't love ourselves. That's what's on. And this is a universal issue. For some people, it's like the big issue in their life. Here's what Sharon Salzberg has to say. The practice of metta, uncovering the force of love that can uproot fear, anger, and guilt, begins with befriending ourselves. The foundation of metta practice is to know how to be our own friend. Then she says, according to the Buddha, you can search throughout the entire universe for someone who is more deserving of your love and affection than you are yourself. And that person is not to be found anywhere. You yourself, as much as anybody in the entire universe, deserve your love and affection. That's quite an amazing statement when you think about it. You deserve your love as much as anyone else in the universe. But we're so used to the idea that I gotta, take care of everyone else, that we forget about ourselves. How few of us embrace ourselves in this way? With metta practice, we uncover the possibility of truly respecting ourselves. We discover, as Walt Whitman put it, I am larger and better than I thought. I did not think I held so much goodness. So that's one view of that. And then I want to present from a different writer, a different view. This is Kevin Griffin's book, Living Kindness, which I would actually, the Loving Kindness book I discovered 20 years ago, this book I discovered last winter. They're equally wonderful, approaching things in different ways. Kevin is more very directly working with what's in the sutta itself and explaining it in the context of loving kindness. But he calls this living kindness, which I think is, that's an interesting way to think of it, right? And this is what he has to say. He says, when it comes to loving others, it makes sense that if our feelings towards ourselves are unkind, any effort to be kind to others will be adulterated. These efforts will always be colored by some form of neediness. Either we will be trying to get validation from others or trying to compensate for our lack of self-worth by being extra good. How many times have we tried that, right? These external efforts will never succeed as long as our inner world feels barren. And it is that very barren feeling that makes us think we don't deserve love. We look inside and see anxiety and sadness, worry and stress, irritation and judgment. Then we equate feeling bad with being bad. That's just brilliant. It's so right on. We equate feeling bad with being bad. In this formulation, if we are bad, then clearly we don't deserve love. Instead of self-judgment, metta encourages us to care for ourselves simply because we are suffering, to be kind to the sadness and worry, to be gentle with the judgment and irritation. We actually give love to those very feelings. Rather than fighting with our inner life, we open to it with acceptance and compassion. It seems brilliant to me. So, but how, what about those, I want to go back to those difficult people. What about those difficult people? How can we, because our reactions are so strong, how can we sort of, can we think of this in a slightly different way? So instead of offering them, of trying to fill our hearts with thoughts of loving kindness towards them, instead of thinking of metta as adding something, wholesome thoughts, can we think of metta as simply removing unwholesome thoughts? We're not trying to add anything, we're just trying to take something away that we see as unwholesome through wise understanding. Yeah. And in the sutta it says, let none deceive another or despise any being in any state, that none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. So is this something we can do, or we can just step back from that? Can we not get caught over and over again in those thoughts of ill will by removing them somehow? And once again, I have a couple of different readings here about this. This is once again Kevin Griffin. The theme of the sutta is the challenge. He's talking about a sutta that called the simile of the saw. The theme of the sutta is the challenge of maintaining non-ill will in the face of attacks, verbal or physical. Here we see one of the rhetorical teaching strategies of the Buddha. He seems to understand that a positive declaration of to love everyone can trigger grasping. It's like, oh, that's something I got to do, right? I got to do that. I got to do it. So instead, points us towards letting go of the obstructions to love. In this way, his rhetoric mirrors the teachings themselves. Letting go is the path to freedom. So he tells us that what it is we need to let go of. If instead we had set out some ideal to strive for, it would just give people something else to chase after and something else to fail at also. And again, the implication is that our natural state, when rid of these negative qualities, is a positive one, that when hatred is removed, love is naturally revealed, that when greed subsides, generosity is spontaneous. This is an essential Buddhist concept, that our fundamental human nature is loving and wise. The work of the practice is to abandon the things that obscure these qualities in us. I love this too. This is like a totally, when I first read this, it was like, oh, never thought of it quite that way before. You know, just let go of those unwholesome thoughts. Don't struggle so much to make this perfect thing, but just let go of the unwholesome thoughts, and the wholesome thoughts will naturally fill up the space. It's just a different way to look at it, I guess. It fascinates me. Once again, Sharon Salzberg here. And this is also equally important. In practicing metta, we do not have to make a certain feeling happen. Somehow that we get the idea for practicing metta, we should be sort of sweet and gushy, right? Just like overflowing with this glowing, sweet energy. In fact, during the practice, we see that we feel differently at different times. Any momentary emotional tone is far less relevant than the considerable power of intention we harness as we say these phrases. As we repeat, may I be happy, may all beings be happy, we are planting seeds by forming this powerful intention in the mind. The seed will bear fruit in its own time. She's referring directly to the Buddha's teachings on intention, how once we've, you know, have right understanding, then what do we need next? Well, the next step on the path is wholesome intention. We have to form the intention. And it's the intention to one day have more loving kindness in our lives and express it more freely. It's that intention that's important. Then the rest comes from having that solid base of intention. Both on the in the broad sense of like, yes, I'm going to try and do this, and on the day-to-day, moment-to-moment intentions, where we see ourselves in the midst of something, and we're going, this is a time when I should pay attention and have thoughts of loving kindness, where I don't want to fall into my habitual patterns. She goes on anyway. When I was practicing metta intensively in Burma, at times when I repeated the phrases, I would picture myself in a wide open field planting seeds. Doing metta, we plant the seeds of love. Knowing that nature will take its course in time, these seeds will bear fruit. Some seeds will come to fruition quickly, some slowly. But our work is simply to plant the seeds. Every time we form the intention in the mind for our own happiness or the happiness of others, we are doing our work. We are channeling the powerful energies of our own minds. Yeah. It's so easy when we are trying to be more meta-ish, I suppose, that we get caught in this space of, oh, it's supposed to feel a certain way. I'm supposed to be a certain way when I'm doing this. It's just the intention. It's the actual intention and then the effort to follow through and act, even if it's the act is simply repeating those phrases. You know, every time you go by, you check out your groceries. Just as you're leaving, you just say the four phrases to the checkout person in your mind. You say them out loud, you might get arrested, but just say them in your own mind. That'll be fine, because it's about changing your heart that's important. I am a volunteer chaplain at the hospital here, and at one point I was teaching nurses metta, and they said, "Well, how can we do this in our, you know, we are so busy all the time running. How can we?" I said, "Just every time you're about to walk into a room, which they do dozens of times a day, right? Every time before you walk, just say the four phrases for the patient and then walk into the room. Take that 5 seconds." And it was like, this was like a revolutionary idea for some of them that, oh, I can actually pause. It changes their heart and changes how they react to the patients. It's just by taking that little moment to connect in that way. So up until now, I've been talking about metta as like some separate thing. This is, and it's often viewed this way. There's this thing called metta, it's one form of practice, and there's this thing called mindfulness, and it's another form of practice. Now I want to disabuse you of that idea and basically say that these two practices are very tightly interrelated. And I want to start by reading to you something from Sylvia Boorstein. So you have to understand, I first started doing long retreats. Sylvia was one of the teachers. And she was unlike all the other teachers. I mean, you know, you're on retreat, people are wearing sweatpants and a t-shirt and maybe a work shirt when it's cold, or, you know, a bulky sweater or something, right? Sylvia, sitting up on the stage, ready to give a Dharma talk, has her hair permed, her gray hair permed in tight little curls. She's wearing a calf-length skirt, a twin set, and pearls. It's like, what's my grandmother doing up there on the stage? But she was like, just like, she didn't mess around. All of her talks, all of the Dharma talks she gave, she'd be talking, oh, and then my son said, and, you know, she'd be playing off her daily life and her reaction with her family, but then bring it straight back to the teachings of the Buddha every time. She was just this powerful. So anyway, this is one of her books called Happiness is an Inside Job. She has another great book called Don't Just Do Something, Sit There. So she has a little wit when she takes into the practice. But this is what she has to say about mindfulness and metta and how they fit together. When I was introduced to metta practice 25 years ago, I was told that it was different, not only in technique, but also in goal from mindfulness. In fact, it was, and still sometimes is, presented as an ancillary practice to use in case of special needs, such as perilous circumstances, or as a formal ritual ending for retreat practice, such as the dedication of merit. And this is something I in my early days of practice, I encountered this, where there'd be like one sitting period a day in a long, all day long retreat. Well, that would take 45 minutes for metta practice. You know, it's like, oh, this is extra, but it's interesting, right? It wasn't like presented as something super important. And the other thing she mentions here is that in case of special needs and perilous circumstances, that's interesting because when the Buddha originally taught the Metta Sutta, he taught it. He was in the forest with a group of monks, and they'd gone to a new place because they wandered, and he'd say, "All right, now go out into the forest, you monks, and sit all day, and then come back in the evening, and we'll have a sangha and do some chanting, and I'll teach them Dhamma." So this is in a new forest they'd never been to before. So at the end of the day, all the monks come back and they're all freaked out. They're all upset. They're all really just like, "Oh, this is a horrible forest. All the tree spirits in the forest are trying to get us to leave." Like they're sort of angry, and like they basically in hippie old day parlance, the vibe of the forest was really scary, right? It was like it really made them uncomfortable. So whether or not you believe in tree spirits or not, that's cool. And then what did the Buddha do? He taught the Metta Sutta. The Metta Sutta was originally taught as an antidote to fear. As an antidote to fear. That's what was the original intent was. Because the Buddha understood that fear often sits right on top of or right below, connected to a lot of other unwholesome mindsets of ill will, like anger, for instance. Anger, often we're angry because we're afraid of something, of the person, of the situation, whatever. And he said, so this was like the idea was that this could be a practice that would help people deal with their fears. What I've come to believe, and Sylvia's going on here, what I have come to believe out of my experience is that mindfulness and metta, although they are associated with different techniques, each of them integral to the practice of the other. I cannot be genuinely mindful, open to my moment-to-moment experience without hesitation or hiding, unless my mind is benevolent, unless I forgive whatever part of my experience arouses distress in me. Indeed, if it is the mindful awareness I'm in pain or someone else's that causes feelings of goodwill to spontaneously arise in me. And I can't seriously practice metta without paying very careful attention to, being mindful of, whether what I am wishing matches what I feel. This is another issue in metta practice, is people can be saying the phrases, but they're sort of on automatic pilot, because if you practice for a long time, they become sort of automatic pilot if you're not careful, and be off in some other train of total rant, but be saying the phrases at the same time. I'm speaking from experience in these matters, because I got there more times than what I care. In my experience, it's repeated direct awareness of how benevolent connection, friendliness, compassion, appreciation liberates my mind from suffering that supports both wisdom and equanimity in me and inspires my determination to stay alert. So I like to say that these two practices, which have very different forms, because they do have different forms, are just, it's like there's this house, and we're trying to get to the center of the house. And we go through one door over here on the west side, another door over here on the east side. They look like really, they're painted different colors. One's on the east, one's on the west. They seem really different. But we get to the middle of the house. It's the same house. They're just different roads into the same place. And in my own personal practice experience, that's true. I've been equally deep, I suppose you could say, in either form, and it gets to be almost indistinguishable in my what I'm experiencing at the time, which of these two forms I'm practicing. At the best times, of course, I'm speaking here. So I want to read one other thing, because it's important also that we think, what does this mean for how we live our lives in the world, are just day to day. If this was like just something we did when we meditated for half an hour repeating these phrases, but it didn't affect how we lived in the world, why bother? I mean, blunt. This has got to be how we live our lives. This has to be our abode. We live in our abode, right? So anyway, there's this great sutta where the Buddha comes to visit these three monks who hang out together and practice together, and he's talking to them about how things are going. And the Buddha says, "I hope, Aruda, that you're living in concord with mutual appreciation, without disputing, blending like milk and water, viewing each other with kindly eyes." And this is how Aruda answers. "Venerable sir, as to that, I think thus. It is a gain for me, it is a great gain for me that I am living with such companions in the holy life. I maintain bodily acts of loving kindness towards these venerable ones, both openly and privately. I maintain verbal acts of loving kindness towards them, both openly and privately. I maintain mental acts of loving kindness towards them, both openly and privately." Notice why he keeps repeating openly and privately. It's like metta is not about showing people how wonderful you are. A lot of this is just how you act in the world and your own heart, and has nothing to do with those other people. It's not like you're trying to fix them or change them or impress them or anything. You're just trying to change your own heart space and how you react to the world. "I consider, why should I not set aside what I wish to do and do what these venerable ones wish to do? Then I set aside what I wish to do and do what these venerable ones wish to do. We are different in body, venerable sir, but one in mind." The venerable, another one of them said, likewise saying, "This is how, venerable sir, we are living in concord with mutual appreciation, without disputing, blending like milk and water, viewing each other with kindly eyes." I love that last phrase. Viewing each other with kindly eyes. Can we look at others always with kindly eyes? It's just so sweet, right? But then the Buddha doesn't, "Well, that's nice, but," he says, "Good Ruta, I hope you all abide diligent, ardent, and resolute." "Surely, venerable sir, we abide diligent, ardent, and resolute. But Ruta, how do you thus abide?" "Venerable sir, as to that, when whichever one of us returns from the village with alms food," so they even though they're living in the forest in their little huts, every day they have to go into the village for alms. That's how they get their one meal a day. "As to that, whichever us returns first from the village with alms food, prepares the seats, sets out the water for drinking and for washing, and puts the refuse bucket in its place. Whichever us returns last eats any food left over, if he wishes. Otherwise, he throws it away where there is no greenery or drops it into water where there is no life." Very ecological. "He puts away the seats and the drinking water for drinking and for washing. He puts away the refuse bucket after washing it, and he sweeps out the refectory. Whoever notices that the pots of water for drinking, washing, or the latrine are low or empty takes care of them. If they are too heavy for him, he calls someone else by a signal of the hand, and they move it by joining hands. But because of this, they do not break out into speech. But every 5 days, we sit together all night discussing the Dhamma. This is how we abide diligent, ardent, and resolute." So what he's saying here, I think, is quite important. It's like, well, we just see what needs to be done in our living situation, and we take care of it. Whoever's there first does this, and then we just take care of it. It's all taken care of. And if we need help, we have simple ways to communicate that we need help, like in their case, because they're trying to keep silence and they do hand signals. But every 5 days, 4 or 5 days, they get together and they talk all night about the Dhamma. So this is like Sangha, right? This is how they grow in the Dhamma. And when I read that, And it reminded me as reading today, I remembered something else. There's this guy back in the, I suppose this is the 70s, a guy named Stephen Gaskin, who started a place called The Farm in Tennessee, which was basically a bunch of hippie freaks going out and trying to form a commune that where they lived communally in a wholesome way. And I once heard Stephen Gaskin speak. He was speaking in where I was living, and he was like doing a tour. And I went to hear him speak, and he said one thing is always stuck in my mind. He says, what he said was, the lowest form of cooperation is turn taking. Yeah, no, it's your turn to do it. No, it's my turn to do it, so I'll do it. But I mean, I won't be keen, but it's my turn. Instead of as he this is described in the Sutta, people go, this is what needs to be done, so I'll do it. And then it's done. And it's like, because you're taking care of the community of people you're involved with, that's the wholesomeness. That's the wholesomeness comes not from thinking about whose turn it is at all, just doing it. It's a different way of, because so often, even in intimate relationships, if we're not careful, we get caught up in turn taking. And a lot of the ill will that arises in relationships is because people aren't taking their turn. This is what marriage counselors, this is marriage counselors' bread and butter, I've just described. This is where they make the big bucks in this that one place, because it's so easy to get caught into that. We're each in our own little thing, and we got to make sure we get our half of everything, and it's all fair. And instead of just speaking and acting and thinking openly and privately from a place of loving kindness. That's what the Buddha encouraged over and over and over again, just to live this in your life in that way. That's tricky. Okay, I have one more thing here. This is a book of poetry by Naomi Shihab Nye. So some of you may not have heard of her. She's a wonderful poet. And this particular poem is called Kindness, which seems kind of relevant to what we've been talking about. And she makes a really important point here, I think. Before you can know what kindness really is, you must lose things. Feel the future dissolve in the moment, like salt in a weakened broth. What you held in your hand, what you counted and carefully saved, all of this must go, so you know how desolate the landscape can be between the regions of kindness. How you ride and ride, thinking the bus will never stop. The passengers eating maize and chicken while you stare out the window forever. Before you learn the tender gravity of kindness, you must travel where the Indian in the white poncho lies dead by the side of the road. You must see how this could be you, how he too was someone who journeyed through the night with plans and the simple breath that kept him alive. Before you know kindness as the deepest thing inside, you must know sorrow as the other deepest thing. You must wake up with sorrow. You must speak to it with till your voice catches the thread of all sorrows and you see the size of the cloth. Then it is only kindness that makes sense anymore. Only kindness that ties your shoes and sends you out into the day to mail letters and purchase bread. Only kindness that raises its head from the crowd of the world to say, it is I you have been looking for, and then goes with you everywhere, like a shadow or a friend. And she's making this great point. All of us as human beings have suffered and will suffer. It's just part of being a human being. It's like my friend David Chernikoff always talked about the 10,000 joys and the 10,000 sorrows. Well, we're going to get our share of the 10,000 sorrows, I guarantee you. Just the way, the nature of things. And it is that very understanding that this is the lot of all beings. All beings have lives that go up and down like this all the time. So the only thing we can do is be kind. The only thing that makes any sense is loving kindness to all beings.